today I'm joined by the wonderful Joanne Bozeman, who has been a voice teacher for almost 50 years. She is a singer herself, was a faculty member at Lawrence University's Conservatory of Music in Wisconsin, and is a frequent presenter for many organisations, including the BVA, NATS and PAVA. Joanne is a co-author of Singing Through Change, Women's Voices in Midlife, Menopause and Beyond, and she joins me today to share her expertise on singing through the stages of menopause. Joanne Bozeman, I'm so thrilled to be in your company today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, and I'm really, really happy and honored to be with you and your listeners.
Menopause is something that impacts a vast chunk of the world's population. Can you explain what menopause actually is and what the different stages are?
Sure. We have to sort of define a term, because menopause technically, clinically, means your periods have stopped and then 1 year later you are in menopause. Menopause happens. So that's sort of a medical term. It's sort of like a graduation day. A lot of people use the term in menopause to mean things are going on, the menopause transition is happening. So I think, you know, we get a little bit sloppy when you use those words. I like to use the word the menopause transition, because it includes the lead up time, which is called perimenopause. Now that word's getting a lot of information in the press these days, which is great. And it is important, because most of the time we are in perimenopause, that lead up time. Somebody explained it like, somebody has put you in a canoe trip and you're going down the river and you don't know what's coming and you don't know when you're going to get off the river. It's something that you find yourself in and then eventually it ends. But the perimenopause is about 8 to 10 years. That's the research is showing. So that whole process, plus that 1 year period, periods end, plus a year, that whole thing is considered in most research the menopause transition. In Europe, it's often called the climacteric. In the US, it's the menopause transition. But most of the time we are talking about stuff that is happening in perimenopause, as our bodies begin to go out of our reproductive status. Some people call it puberty in reverse, which makes sense to a degree. Because when we enter puberty, we have not been able to be fertile, and then we are in this fertile state. So menopause transition is about reversing that process. We go out of fertility. So in a way that is correct, except we don't have the growth things that are going on. So the stages are, again, there's so many different ways of researching this, but the site I like talks about early perimenopause. Early perimenopause is when we're still having periods. A lot of people think you can't be having hot flushes or whatever because you're still having periods. But these changes are still happening because the hormone levels are often declining, but also being very irregular, spiking, falling. So this sort of regular interaction between estrogen and progesterone is going kind of chaotic. So the periods may still be regular, but the time between them may be shortening. The length may be shortening. So there are some changes, but they're sort of subtle at this point. Even so, we can still have some changes. Night sweats, hot flushes are really common. Maybe even some little mood changes. It could be even some changes in skin and other tissues, vaginal tissue, bladder tissue. I remember getting weird, creepy, crawly sensations on my back. And I look back on it, I go, that was menopause, or I should say perimenopause. So anyway, yeah. So even when we're having regular periods, we can still start having some symptoms. Late menopause is when the periods are really getting chaotic. Mm-hmm. The hormones are much more representing a decline. They're still goofy. But periods are generally spacing out. You may skip ovulatory patterns. So you may go, you know, a couple of months without a period and then have one, and then maybe go 4 months and then have one. So that's a sign when that gradually opening up pattern, that means we're in the late menopause. So when you have that last menstrual period, it's very hard to know that it's the last one unless you have certain hormonal measurements. But generally speaking, that year period is this like, okay, you're done.
Mm. I guess as a cis female, I want to know why I have to go through it. Why is it something that we have to have? Is it part of the aging process? And we spoke a little bit before we came on about menopause and the aging process and how they're related.
Right. They overlap. The reason I, with our book and our audience and pedagogy sources, we are really trying to tease out this subject out from the aging voice umbrella for a couple of reasons. Menopause can happen much younger than old age. In fact, menopause is not an old age situation. It's a midlife situation for most women because the average age is 51 in the West. And the perimenopause leading up is happening in our 40s typically, or even earlier, late 30s. So if we may feel like we're getting older, but in terms of research on old age, that begins more like 60 or 65. Mm-hmm. So even in voice research, that's where that is happening. So this idea of midlife voice changes, I think, is a much more helpful way to look at it. Frankly, most when you do find the subject in pedagogy sources, it tends to be in the aging voice area. And I want to say, let's move it out of there, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you could be in your 30s. I talked a long time and helped a woman write an article who is a professional singer, and she went into perimenopause in her late 30s. Mm-hmm. And so that's not old age, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes we call it reproductive senescence or aging. That's a good term, I think. Sure, our reproductive system is affected by our age and other things, yes. Why do we have to go through this? I don't know. Well, when you think about it, it can be a difficult situation for some people. And I'm going to just back up a little bit and say here, the experience is so variable about menopause in general. I have talked to people that say, I didn't have one hot flush, or I had one. That was it. I stopped menstruating. I was done. What is everybody complaining about? I've heard that. I think that's unusual because the research says that about 80% of people complain of some kind of symptoms, usually the hot flush, night sweat thing, but other things. And then there's some people that are almost disabled by symptoms, horrible joint pain, and other symptoms, you know, that makes it difficult even to work. Mm-hmm. They have to change their work circumstance. So you have this other group it's very, very difficult. And then you have, I think, more people, it's like, this is yucky, I hate it, I'm not enjoying this, when is it going to end? But manage it with lifestyle changes, sometimes pharmaceutical things like HRT or whatever, adapting at work. So I think most people have it like that. Now, the big question of why, it's really interesting that most mammals do not go through menopause. Mm-hmm. Like rodents just keep ovulating till they die. Okay. Now, some mammals do go through menopause. We do. Orca whales do, some dolphins. Very, very few actually have a menopause. So there are people that are doing research saying, what's the point? What's the evolutionary significance of this? And it has probably to do with when we are not responsible for youngsters directly, when we're not producing our young, we're freed up to do other things. And with orca whales, so interesting, they're actually showing where the food is and they're looking after young so the mothers can do their thing. So it's thought perhaps that it puts us in a situation where we can nurture young, pass on wisdom when we're not having to deal with pregnancy, breastfeeding of our own. So
looking at the hormonal journey, studies from the likes of Robert T. Sateloff have described how there's an indistinguishable link between the cervix and the larynx during menstruation regarding the levels of the estrogen and progesterone. What do these hormones mean for the voice and what happens to them during menopause?
Yeah, I have to give credit to that actual research to a number of researchers, but particularly Dr. Jean Habitbol, who's a French laryngologist, and his team. There are others doing similar work, but he probably publicized it most for the voice world, and his wife was involved in this research, who is a gynecologist. she encouraged him to do this kind of research where they're comparing the epithelial cells, that means the mucus cells of the vocal folds, to the epithelial cells of the uterine cervix. And they tracked a number of women through their cycle, and they would take samples of those cells and then compare the two areas, so larynx versus the cervix. And they found that over time, these cells mimicked each other in appearance based on the time of the cycle. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty compelling evidence, not really surprising to women, mm-hmm. that their voice seemed subject to changes along with their menstrual cycle. So when that research came out in the 80s, and again, there were other researchers that were doing similar work that confirmed it, I think a lot of women went, yes, we were right. And there's evidence for centuries that women have, singers, there were excused from singing in opera houses in the period of time before their period, and perhaps through the period. So they would be excused from performing at that time. So this evidence has been around for a long time. And then the science evidence came along and said, yeah, this is going on. So when estrogen is high, there are certain things going on at the larynx and the cervix. And then when estrogen is low, there are certain changes that happen. And I can get into more detail about that if you want. So, I do want to say one thing right now. I have one big old disclaimer. Just like women go through menopause in really, really different ways, women's bodies, I'm just going to say bodies experiences with hormonal shifts are extremely individualistic. And so when we talk about this, I think it's really important to say may, might, possibly, could versus will. Okay. Yeah. So if I sound slightly mamby-pamby about these things, it's because it's so different. You know, like I had a lot of trouble with my voice in perimenopause and shortly after menopause. I have a colleague who's just very close to my age. She didn't seem to have any trouble at all. I believe her. So when we set ourselves up for either disappointment or we set ourselves up for, you know, everything's going to be fine, we got to play both ends of the spectrum, you know. So these responses are extremely individualistic, and they have a lot to do with genetics. We'll talk about genre maybe a little bit in terms of effect or ways around lifestyle, what kind of vocal folds are coming into the perimenopause, you know, how many miles on the tire, so to speak, has there been a vocal injury in the past? There's so many variables, vocal habits, just being in shape or out of shape. All these things can make a difference in how we experience. And just, we all have, I remember reading somewhere, a laryngologist suggests that some bodies are just more sensitive to estrogen, for instance. Mm-hmm. And estrogen is the sort of vocal fold happy hormone. And overarchingly, I think I can say that. Okay, so the three hormones we're talking about, we sometimes call them reproductive, but I don't tend to use that word except to get in the door, because they do so much more in our bodies than our reproductive functions, okay? Hormone receptors in our brain, our bones, our inner ears, our respiratory system, all over the body we have estrogen receptors, so and the vocal folds. So it's important to think about that. So these three sex steroid hormones we're talking about are estrogen, progesterone, and androgens. Sometimes I'll say estrogen, but most of the time I'm going to say estrogen. So what kinds of things happen regarding the vocal folds with these sex steroid hormones? Estrogen contributes thickness and smoothness and pliability to that epithelium, that mucosal layer of the vocal folds. So when estrogen is higher, there are actually more cellular layers in this tissue. Estrogen increases oxygenation to the vocal folds because it allows better permeability of the capillaries. And then we have capillaries all through this tissue. When estrogen is high, we have thin, watery mucus, and that's really important in vocal fold vibration, as we know. And this mucus comes from little tiny glands that are just above and below the vocal folds. And estrogen supports the materials and the composition of the lamina propria. These are those little thin layer-ish sorts of things underneath the epithelium of the vocal folds. And the substances found in it are elastin, collagen, hyaluronic acid. It includes these things. And if you go, oh, golly, I use a face cream that has some of this stuff. Yes, it's the same stuff that we have in our skin and our connective tissues all over our bodies. Estrogen supports skeletal muscles and bone health all over. Now, progesterone causes these epithelial cells to slough off. So when progesterone is higher dominant, so the epithelium is actually less thick. It causes decreased and thicker secretions of the glands near the vocal folds, and that causes dryness, which can lead to higher vocal effort. Progesterone decreases permeability of the fold capillaries, and when it's out of balance with estrogen, it can lead to swollen vocal folds, sometimes called edema, so it's like trapped fluid. Now, both progesterone and estrogen have supporting effects on nerves and the central nervous system. And progesterone actually is sort of a calming hormone. That's kind of interesting, so it's not all bad. Now, androgens, yes, female bodies have androgens. They are much lower levels than in XY or male bodies, though its effects may increase as we experience lowering or erratic estrogen levels in perimenopause, because estrogen sort of blocks the effects of androgens. So this is why we may see some things like the vocal folds may thicken, which leads to lower pitch. We may have difficulty with upper range. We may have changes in vocal timbre, changes in the epithelium. And I like to talk about androgens, and testosterone is one of the androgens. I want to talk about it because when androgens get to a particular level, we can have permanent changes of the vocal folds. Now, that's a desirable effect for people that are taking cross-sex hormones to become trans males. So in that case, that's a desirable effect for people, singers that want to retain their high range. You need to be careful. And I don't know if this is the case in the UK, but in the United States, there are clinics that do HRT, use HRT, and they sometimes throw some testosterone in the mix. For singers, they need to be really careful of this if they want to, you know, preserve that high range. So always be aware of what's going on, because we don't want to have permanent changes if they're not desired. The epithelium and the superior layer of the lamina propria are particularly sensitive to hormone effects, and singers particularly are really sensitive to subtle changes in vocal fold behavior, remodeling, and these conditions that can occur from hormonal shift. And I'll just throw in, and we're also very sensitive to issues like illness, bad sleep patterns, and all these other things. So anyway, that's sort of the background information of estrogen and progesterone. I think the next step is like, okay, so what happens in perimenopause and menopause, right? So I'm going to go through some symptoms, which will make a little bit more sense now that we've talked about the general effects of estrogen and progesterone. And I want to say that these symptoms we've consolidated from several sources. Not all singers have negative experiences, so we're not going to talk ourselves into it, as I said. And as I go through this list, I want to just also emphasize that not every symptom that I'm talking about is going to be present in every woman. So we're talking about either nothing to the voice is really falling apart to something kind of in between. And we see that also in studies where we may have major facts, most no, maybe concerning things, but in some cases, no big deal. So, but these are fairly common complaints. One of them is vocal fold dryness and thick mucus. So as we can see, when estrogen goes down and maybe progesterone is a little bit more present, we don't have that good lubrication that we're used to. Some women complain of their voice feeling stiff, inflexible, or less inflex, feels less elastic. This can be correlated to impaired agility, that the voice just doesn't move as fast, harder to do riffs, runs, arpeggios, unpredictability. It's like, I think I know how to sing. One day I open my mouth and something comes out, which is fine. And then the next day I go to sing the same way. Something else comes out of my mouth. And again, it's like I'm changing my habits. I'm not changing my approach. My voice is changing. And when you look at graphs of the hormonal craziness, you can kind of understand why there might be some changeability. Some women find their voices unstable, and that normally they're not flippers or crackers, but they find, yeah, the voice is unstable. Lowered upper range is pretty common. Complaints of my top is not as easy, or I've lost some notes on top. It's not always, but it mentioned. Or uncomfortable singing. I can sing up there. I got all the notes, but I just am not happy there. Weakness or loss of power, even breathiness, vocal fatigue are sometimes talked about. Difficulties in the passaggios or the bridges or whatever you call them, registration transition points, so that coordination is just not as smooth, predictable. Pitch insecurities. This is the one that's kind of interesting. Like somebody just bang on great pitch and all of a sudden, ooh, whoa, I can tell I'm flatting. I don't even hear it. I don't feel it. But I go back to the piano, ding, ding, ding. I am out of tune. What's happening? That's very frustrating. I've never heard anybody saying they're sharping, but it's flatting. Change of timbre, a loss of clarity, I talked about breathiness, or even a rough voice. You know, if there is some swelling of those tissues, but it's not even, so you might have some rough tone. And for some genres, maybe that's not a big deal. But in, you know, particularly classical Western singing, that is a problem. Now, for many women, the positive change is a gain of lower range, that all of a sudden, oh, I got low notes I never thought I'd ever have. So most of the women like that. There's particularly the higher voices that never had much on the bottom. So that's a positive change. Along with these things, if they're happening or to the degree they're happening, there was a wonderful study that was done by a friend of mine here in the States, Martha Elliott, where she did a survey of women, and she wanted to ask them about their emotional reactions along with the physical symptoms they were reporting. But this confusion, sadness, a loss of confidence, self-blame is really common. Like, oh, I guess I don't know how to sing, or I've never been a good singer. That's a common feeling. Isolation, particularly if you seem to be the only person that's going through this. I kind of felt that for sure. We had a woman on our Facebook page that says, I'm so glad to have found this site because I was just silently wondering. So, you know, just in that, finding somebody to say, oh yeah, you're not making this up. Your symptoms do align with what could be happening hormonally. You know, for me, it took a voice teacher I was working with, and she could tell I was struggling with some things. And she said, you think it could be menopause? And I went, what? I had no idea. I'm a very educated voice health person, you know, and I didn't even know at that time. So
you mentioned about how this is going to be very individual and we're not all going to experience every single symptom. Maybe none. Is there any suggestion in the research that there's a pattern to who might experience this more over somebody else? And is there a link between somebody who might have had a vocal pathology in the past to what they experience on their voice during this time?
I think that's a wonderful question, and I would love to see that researched. I don't really have an answer to that. I can guess a little bit. Clearly, somebody who has had a vocal pathology in the past, particularly if it's left some scarring or something like that, you add in maybe vocal fold edema or unpredictability that might make things more challenging. I would say that's one reason I really encourage midlife women who are super busy, I understand this, to not neglect practicing. Keep practicing, you know. Don't just show up for choir and sing, you know, sing during the week in the shower, keep the voice going. Because I think that when we enter this time of life in better shape vocally, I think it could help. Now that I think that's a wise thing to say. Now that said, for me, I was not out of practice. I had been singing and all of a sudden, what? These things started happening, going, what? Because I wasn't out of shape. I was regularly practicing and performing and teaching and so on. So, but I still give the advice to keep the voice going. Body type might have something to do with it. This because we do produce estrogen in our fat cells. Someone who has a bit more padding, if you will, I don't mean this in a bad way, but larger women, there are studies that show that women that have a higher BMI, their voices don't lower as much. It's right. Kind of in line with women that are on HRT. So there is a trend there. I'm not saying that we should, you know, gain weight or anything like that, but women who are maybe very thin, they may have more of an effect. This is highly speculative. Now, Dr. Abit Bal does talk about these things in his writing, so I'm not making that up.
Is pathology more common during this stage because of potential symptoms?
That's a great question. And honestly, and I'm going to just talk a tiny little bit about our book. The book Singing Through Change, Women's Voices in Midlife, Menopause and Beyond was released almost 3 years ago. It was like right in COVID. We wanted to write a book about the voice and the menopausal journey and beyond. And I jumped in immediately when these co-authors who approached me, they'd already been talking about it, said, we want to do it based on interviews. And I went, I'm in because this experience is so variable. And when we just look at studies, they're, you know, everything's kind of boiled down to averages and statistics, and it doesn't really talk about that huge experience. So it is qualitative in approach. Now, we interviewed 56 women, and we were surprised in this particular population. It was anywhere from a couple of shower singers to, you know, high-ranking elite singers in their field, and all places in between. Many genres are represented, so it's a wide variety of singers. Now, we did find a surprisingly high amount of vocal injury in this group, and I think it was somewhere around 33%. Now, it wasn't a present injury; it was something that they had had, or were experiencing at the time. So, in that bunch, we did see this, and I thought, oh, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about, are these vocal injuries related to their hormonal status and vocal changes? Possibly. I'm going to tell one story just in case it makes sense. So we have a woman who is a very experienced church musician, choral singer, high soprano, very much in that Anglican tradition. It was like a perfect storm. She was at Christmas time. She had family in town. This particular woman had a very handicapped daughter that was living with them. So the stress of caretaking, okay, all these things. But she was singing a solo she'd sung many, many times on Christmas Eve, familiar thing, but she had a cold. Oh, by the way, she was in perimenopause. Got to add that in. She's in perimenopause. She said, well, I can do this, right? I can get through this. She sang through it, got to the high note, and she felt something happen in her throat. And she said, after that was when she was 47 or 49 or something. She said, after that happened, I don't know what happened, but my top voice has never been the same. Now, she didn't, because of everything going on in her life, she did not go to the doctor to see what maybe had happened. She regrets that, you know. But of course, we can suggest perhaps that she had a vocal fold hemorrhage because of all the things that were going on, you know, singing, pushing through when she was not. Well, it could be that she had, there is some evidence that when progesterone is high, we get increased vascularity on the vocal folds. There's some really interesting studies where they do different colored lights, and we say, oh my gosh, look at all those little microvarices showing up. It's very possible that she had an enlarged little capillary, went for the high note, and it just, you know, couldn't handle the strain. It sounds like a perfect storm. And so one of our messages is don't push through. Don't push through. Don't force yourself to sing when you're ill. Don't force yourself to sing soprano one if it's not comfortable. Talk to your choir director. Don't force yourself to sing in a higher key that is good. And that's the one thing that in certain genres, you can't change the key, right? Mm-hmm. Adapt as needed. There are other stories in the book where we say, oh yeah, you know, we're not blaming at all. I mean, we've all sung while we're sick, right? But when we can avoid, when we can also find the best voice care possible, this is also another challenge for people. I'm sure it's the case in the UK and the United States. We are so far in many situations from major urban areas where the universities, there are great voice clinics, but sometimes people are hundreds of miles away and they think it's hopeless to find good care, you know, but it's important to get it with online care. That's actually better now. That's one thing that COVID maybe has helped us with, you know, so telehealth, at least a triage effect or a triage situation could happen. So yes, it happened more often in our population than I was expecting. Does that answer?
Yeah, for sure.
And it could be just purely a vocal health issue or a, you know, an unfortunate vocal choice. It could be putting that on top of poor sleep, that could put in, or swollen vocal folds from hormonal shift. It's very hard to parse these things, but I think we do need to consider that possibility.
Is it a good time to talk about genre?
Yeah, sure. My thoughts here are my opinion, but I've also talked to other smart people about this, and I think there's something to that. I do believe that certain kinds of singing, Western classical tradition, perhaps exposes the voice in menopause, an affected voice, let's put it that way, an affected voice, perhaps a little bit more, because particularly high tessitura soprano stuff, that's one thing that women complain about, is just the sustaining things. That's something that's called on in classical singing a lot. You know, it's high, soaring, long legato lines. It's up there, it's exposed. And boy, if you get that little kind of pitch saggy thing, that's a problem. Versus something that's more speechy, that's in and out, that's more pattery, that the notes aren't as long. So there's a stylistic thing. Though I will say this, that there is another researcher, PhD, no, sorry, DMA, where she interviewed lead singers, Barbara DeMaio Fox, and she actually talked to some mezzos that found that their lower passaggio, that they're in and out all the time, was bothering them. So it's not just the high thing, right? So we have our classical genre, or we have people that say, I sing for soprano, so I'm always at the top of the staff or that kind of thing. Will that bother more? Perhaps. Relative to, and again, I'm not, my genre is not CCM, but when I hear jazz singing, I hear pop singing, the range is sometimes less. So Patti LaBelle pops up to a high C. So, but there are more options. There are more choices that one can make, right? Perhaps in a gig, we can change the key. We can change the riff. We can change the harmony. We can change the notes. In classical, we don't have a lot of choices. We can't change the key of an opera or an oratorio. We can change our song choices, perhaps, but in theater pieces, we can't. Some of that slides over into musical theater, right? So if you have more legit kind of situation, that might be an effect there. So I also think the expectations in classical singing are quite rigid about what something should sound like, must sound like, you know. There's very little room for an unclear tone. Whereas in other genres, you know, a little grit, a little roughness maybe is a good thing, right? So if the voice is a little puffier feeling, it's not the end of the world. So that's kind of how I approach that question. So it'd be an interesting study to do, I think.
Yeah. When we are working with singers who are experiencing some of these symptoms, in another scenario, we might pull out a tool from our exercise toolbox and say, right, this is going to help us move through laryngeal passaggio or acoustic passaggio. Is that going to be redundant now, or are these exercises still going to have purpose?
I love the way you pose that question. Yes, and maybe no. So yeah, we want to talk a little bit about pedagogy. And I do want to say that when we wrote our book, I think at the outset, we thought we were going to be able to have a chapter on how to teach the situation, exercises, la, la, la. Then we just realized the more we learned about these different scenarios that it's very hard to be prescriptive in a very definitive way. Okay. So there are no exercises in this book. there are some people that teach about aging voice and older voice that you can find those exercises, but I think it really, really depends on who you're teaching. So a couple of things I want to just talk about. First, as always, we have to teach the person in front of us, right? But if a singer comes in and say that it's, a female body, age 49, and you don't even need to say, oh my gosh, are you, like my teacher asked me, and which is fine, we were very comfortable with each other, but like a male teacher may not feel comfortable inquiring about that. But if the person says, my voice is feeling strange, it doesn't feel like my voice anymore. I remember saying, somebody put a new larynx in here, this is not my larynx anymore. That's what it felt like to me. Believe this person. I was talking to a choral director about this, and he said, well, I usually tell them, I said, they sound fine. I'm going, I appreciate that. But when we say you sound fine, it's a little bit of a tiny little gaslighting, because they may sound fine, but they know what they're feeling. They know how their voice is reacting or not reacting. So believe them. Okay, let's see what's going on. Let's see what we got here. I don't believe there's one set of magic exercises, though I do have to say, because I read stuff, there is one study that looked at menopausal voice relative, so using resonant voice strategies, which most voice teachers are using, this is a speech thing, that they were looking at singers, that they did resonant voice versus alignment and, neck and head freedom, and that resonant voice showed better results, so that's cool. Another researcher whom I respect a lot suggests that Stemple vocal function exercises, I don't know if you know about those.
Joe Stemple, is that the...
Joseph Stemple, yeah. That group of exercises is probably efficacious too. So in some cases, that might be something to look at. So that is a system of exercises. So, but beyond that, there are several things. I think that singers do also need to take some responsibility on for accepting their voices changing all their life, right? Mm-hmm. And that when our voice has a particular timbre and sound when we're 25, that may not be quite the same when we're 49, and not trying to superimpose this young sound on top of all kinds of things change in our bodies. The larynx drops a little bit as we age. The vocal tract angles and nooks and crannies change, even with gain of weight and loss of weight, believe it or not. So those things are evolving through life, and we have to accept those things. So just, it's like, if you're trying to sound like you're 25-year-old self, is like wearing a shirt that's too tight or something. So fine, let your voice be what it is at the right age. So, because you actually can get into some sort of funny vocal habits by making the voice younger sounding. It's almost like a character voice thing. So going with you as you are. I talked already about helping the singers avoid pushing through. That never did that. But when we're talking about sort of voice function, I think all these things are still there, stretching the voice, contracting the voice, talking about thick, thin folds in isolation, balanced registration, using, lofty, domey, legit sounds, as well as good, healthy twang, and then flexibility, both of moving quickly between notes and then language articulation. This language thing is pretty important, even in midlife. Nerves can start to slow down a little bit, so we need to keep calling on them. So all those things are still in place, but the recipe will be different from singer to singer. So is it okay if I just sort of go through a basket of ideas that should be helpful?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. And I'm going to talk about some acoustic strategies that can be helpful. I'm going to highlight what those are as I come to them, okay?
Brilliant.
So obviously, involve your student, as we do. How does something feel? Is that better? Is that worse? So this is important. And, midlife singers, when they come to us, have a lot of experience. They're not 20. They've been singing for decades, and they really do know their voices quite well. Sometimes asking questions lead to interesting situations. I'm going to tell a story about one of my dear students, was a fine choral director and violinist, but hadn't done a ton of voice training. She'd sung chorally, so she came to me when she was about 60. And so she is the older voice, but it was such a wonderful lesson for me We were working. I remember making some headway, but it wasn't quite clicking the way I hoped. And one day I said, you know, I would love to hear your sort of lullaby voice. Can you just sing to me like maybe a nursery song or something that you would have sung to a grandchild, you know? And she sang it and I went, oh, here's where we need to go. So I heard this much freer, I don't like the word lighter, but I'm going to say lighter. Just the more natural voice that sounded like her speaking voice. And I said, that's really nice. And she said, but I want to sound like Renee Fleming. And I said, I do too, but we are not Renee Fleming, you know. So it was so good to ask that question. It's like, what was going on in her brain? You know, what kind of sound was she trying to come up with, which is not a physiologic fix with her body, right? So that was kind of, we laughed. We had a big laugh about that. So she has good taste, though. So yeah. Sometimes in these situations, we have to maybe do a little bit of talking about how they're practicing, what they're doing, you know, maybe just reassess what's going on. Particularly when a voice is maybe having some vocal fatigue, spaced practice time, not super long in each session. And also understanding that my friend Becky Mosley Morgan is doing a beautiful study in the UK about mature voice. So it would include sort of 50s and beyond. And her research has shown that given a certain regimen of exercises, in her case, they were asked to do these things most days a week, and getting through them was about 20 minutes. Mm. That's not a lot of time, and she has wonderful results. So we don't have to do an hour and a half a day, right? And we can't, most of us. So bits of practice are useful. Again, strategizing what's going on with the voice. And also, I just want to say, be patient. One thing that's important to attend to are potential compensations. Like, I'll just use myself as an example. My voice was feeling so funky and so different, so not me. I didn't mean to use my jaw tension and tongue tension. It's kind of what people do sometimes when they're singing when they're sick, right?
Yeah.
So I was doing something along those lines. My teacher brought it to my attention. I went, you know, but it's very important. Sometimes we can talk about it directly. Sometimes it's not a good idea to talk about directly, but understanding that compensatory behaviors are not chosen any more than somebody who has a sprained ankle decides to limp. It's just an adaptation that needs to happen. I remember one of my favorite voice rehabilitator people said, a vocal compensation is as natural as you blinking if something's coming toward you. There's no guilt in that, right? So people should not feel stupid or like a bad singer if they have gotten in some compensatory habits. It's just, but we do have to deal with them because that can make things worse. Mm-hmm. So working on that if they're there, and that could be tongue, jaw, head, neck tension, just stiffness in the body. There's so many ways that can manifest, but just be aware that that can sometimes happen. Body and breath support, whatever people call it. Sometimes we have to get back to that, the basics and alignment, as we know. And I'm going to use the T word. I'm going to use the word trauma here because I don't mean to. This is a tiny little trauma that's going on here in this case with the voices going on the fritz. And so there's a fear thing. And so sometimes breathing becomes impacted, you know, like almost, you know, pulling up, these kinds of things, working on those kinds of things may be needed. My colleague Kate says, pay attention to how she is wearing her body. I love that. Pay attention. I think that SOVTs, semi-occluded vocal tract strategies, exercises can really play a role. As we're hearing, they're not a magic solution in every situation, but they can be very helpful here, I think. Particularly if somebody's got into a pushy, sort of pressury mode, we can use big straw and water, lax voice, a box, or whatever they're called, and, you know, all kinds of things. And there's so many variety, anywhere from fricatives to lip trills to whatever. So just experiment, find what's working well. Those can be used. I do believe it's important, I think, for every voice, but for voices that are going through midlife and beyond. And I'm quoting Ingo Tietze here, who is, you know, arguably one of the greatest voice researchers in the world. He said that when, as we go through age, we need to continue stretching the voice. We need to elasticize the voice, because he believes that when we do that, we cause the underlying tissues of the lamina propria, those cellular materials, to stay lined up versus getting scrambled. There is evidence in old age, or those tissues get a little chaotic. So he feels that that continual stretching will help preserve the voice. I think that's important. So that's for everybody. Now, just because we're sirening up to as high as is comfortable doesn't mean, you know, I can't sing descants anymore. Some might, but, you know, it doesn't mean we're going to get back where we were, but it does. I just like the idea of that preserving the vocal tissues, those underlying lamina propria layers, is really important. And but I also think the other case is true with the lower voice. I think we do need to get into, I don't know what y'all call it. I call it chest voice or mode one, whatever. You know, yes, use the entire capability of those vocal tissues, chest voice, head voice, whatever, and then that blending. Okay, yeah. So yes, attending to that registration. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So SOVTs are actually acoustic strategies. I want to just highlight that because they do cause things to go out of the vocal tract that help vocal efficiency. Mm-hmm. Alongside of this are these helpful consonants. Sometimes people are scared of consonants. I particularly love them. I think that particularly glides and fricatives, nasals, all of these have acoustic benefits on the voice. If we go woo or vv, we're kind of doing it, or even a whoop or yuh. Those are like tiny little straw phonations as we're going into a note. Now, those can be really, really helpful. So don't just vowels is not always a great idea. Ease and efficiency. I talked earlier about sometimes when we're scared the voice is not working, we just push, or we overbreathe, or we just shove air through. Working on ease and efficiency, and sometimes that's making sure we're getting, you know, the best vocal fold closure as we can without squeezing. Collecting and slenderizing through the middle voice. This is using close vowels where we're having some struggles versus open vowels, particularly the ah. And I think a lot of people don't quite understand, maybe male voice teachers and singers, they're quite happy on ah, and there are acoustic reasons for this. In our mid-range, ah is maybe not our best strategy. So using the close vowels, a, o, u, may be a better way to go. This Peggy Baruti, who I mentioned earlier, she goes, I call ah the naked vowel. And this audience went, all the women went, you know. Mm-hmm. So ah in the middle voice is not the same as ah in the upper voice. So we have to, and sometimes we have to put some clothes on that naked ah to make it work more easily. So vowel modification, ah, not ah. Some singers may need to rebalance their registration strategies. You know, if they've beefed it up too much, if their chords feel thick, you know, they may kind of run with that and say, okay, let's figure out how to keep bringing down thinner chord feelings. However you talk about that. So we may need to negotiate that. Resonant voice strategies. Again, this is acoustic. Twang, whatever y'all call it. Twang, nya-nya, retroflex R, the the weird. I don't know if you've had Chadley Ballantyne to talk to you.
Yeah, love
Chadley. So these all things can be very helpful. They tend to entrain more efficiency at the larynx, and we get more resonant strategy. You know, we feel the voice more. It feels more dependable when we work from that position, I think. Key change, the key of comfortable. I borrowed that from a friend of mine. And it's not always lower. We may assume everything has to go on, but not necessarily. We may need to, you know, the voice may be adjusting in a way. I actually am comfortable a step higher on that piece. So being aware of that. For choral singers, I don't know if you've been working in that area, but so many people, our identity is so often only the section we sing in, right? Oh, I'm a first soprano. Wow. And saying I'm not a first soprano anymore is really hard sometimes. But if the voice is functioning more healthily and comfortably in second or dipping down to first alto, we need to learn to let go of that. Say, I'm doing better here. That's fine. Thank you. Wow. Working with the choral director to allow this shift, moving between sections. Do we always have to sing second, maybe I can pop up to first on this piece because it's not as high, or whatever. A knowledgeable choral director can really help women keep singing during this time, because think how many, you know, how many people are singing in choirs? How many are females, cis females, right? So that's good. And even maybe changing sections between pieces in all kinds of ways to dice that. Mm. I love the term neutral voice. I call it the happy birthday voice, which means, what is your voice that you use when you're singing happy birthday with a crowd, right? Some of this I'm addressing to classical singers who can really fill out that sound, max out their resonance. You know, do we really want to sing to a kindergarten class with that voice? Maybe not, right? So I think all singers need to have their neutral voice, which is highly related to speech-like quality. And I think that neutral voice might need to be recalibrated a little bit, perhaps. It's appropriate to what's going on, which leads me to cross-genre singing. Mm. This is very important to me personally, because this saved my life. This saved my life during that time. I could not sing the Brahms Requiem. I was having trouble singing the Mozart Requiem, for that matter. But I could delve into certain musical theater songs, the American Songbook, which I had, you know, grown up hearing. So it wasn't strange to me. I wasn't specializing in that. As I said, that saved my heart, my soul, because of that. I can still sing songs. I can still be musical. I can still learn new music and learn new ways, tonal adjustments. I can do pattery things, and that's okay. So that was so helpful to me, because it didn't demand the things that were difficult for me. I think it's very important. And I think it's, in general, I think it's good for all singers to be able to be fluid as much as possible between styles. And I know that in musical theater, this is almost critical, right? Mm. Yeah. To work in musical theater. So I think it's good for the voice. And I digress just a little bit. There is some evidence from voice work, theater voice work, that the more varieties of voice used in stage training, the healthier the voice. And I think we can extrapolate that to singing. Mm. I even talked to Kitty Vertolini about that. I said, am I safe saying that? She goes, I think, yes. I think that we don't have like research evidence. It makes sense that there's not necessarily one typical mode of speaking or singing that is voice preservative. Probably lots of singings, lots of styles, lots of ways of doing things healthily are good for the voice. That's why I like cross-genre training. The other thing is, it's often takes some weight off the voice. It's speech-like. It's maybe less about vibrato, right? It's like, oh, I can't sustain that. I don't need to always vibrate. I think that's good for singers.
Vibrato. Is vibrato going to be impacted then? Is that what you've seen in singers, that vibrato is harder to access or tends to straighten out?
Okay, good question. You know, you sometimes see vibrato changes on those lists, and I don't usually cite that because I think there's so many things that can affect vibrato. I do not understand what perimenopause would do to cause the vibrato to slow down. There's a tiny bit of evidence that it is. In one very large study, it was a very minor slowing of the vibrato, hardly noticeable. So that study I trust because it's so big, and it's pre, peri, post. I think that, like, what if a woman is beginning to compensate and she's doing funny things with her tongue root? And then the voice begins to wobble, or the voice is getting weighted up too much. And that, so is that a hormonal thing, or is that something separate? So that's why I don't really like to say, oh, the voice will begin to wobble. I don't think I can say that. I think that slower vibrato is a little bit more about an older age issue, though it can be minimized in a lot of cases, but it kind of depends on the genre, right? So great question. I don't know if I answered it satisfactorily, but I don't think we can say will or even a trend there unless it's very minor. I would look at other issues in the singing to figure out why the vibrato is getting super slow. Unusual vocal sounds. Won't be a surprise to y'all. I think, and I I've always thought this, and I talked to a friend of mine who is a PhD speech pathologist in New York City who works with singers, and he says, it's very hard to get certain singers to let go of their only beautiful sound, right? Mm-hmm. But to go, sometimes we've got to go in another door to find a different way of doing things that's more efficacious. So I love weird, playful stuff, and I encourage it in my students and in myself. Weird is different, but it's not bad, right?
Yeah.
If it feels better, it's like, oh my gosh, oh, that thing didn't go flat that time. I was singing like a witch right now. I'm making a really weird, honky, twangy sound. Oh, that is not sagging. So there's something going on. How can I use that? Mm. And then somehow drift into, trickle down into a different way of singing and not losing that. So it's this cross-pollination of things that are going on. And I think it's very important. And we probably end up with, you know, our beautiful sound, but it'll be a different kind of thing. So yes, weird and crazy and playful, silly, all good things to bring in. And for certain singers, you may need to do a lot of convincing, but
for sure,
if they'll go with you, I think that there's often a wonderful thing down the trail. This next thing is about registration, but our passaggios and our acoustic events may need to be renegotiated just a little bit. You may find that the break or the bridge or whatever is going down a little bit or might go up, but just realize that things do evolve and like, oh my gosh, look what happened there. I'll use an example of a classical singer who she just said that her upper notes weren't blooming like they had been. And so we were playing around. I said, you know, I actually think she had been accustomed to opening up vowels at a certain point above the staff or near the top of the staff, depending on the vowel. And I said, I think you need to open up earlier now. I think you used to open up whatever on an A flat. Let's try opening on G or F and see what happens. She went, oh yeah, it's just working with changes in the vocal tract that naturally happen as we get older or whatever. So that might be negotiated. And I think when we're working with these wonderful people is we do need to be extremely positive. Praise the voice, praise the work that's going on. It may feel like baby steps to them, but you know, stay in the moment, don't project, you know, just do what you're doing with the voice on the day that you're working with it and not think, oh my God, I want to say, you know, I have a gig down there. Like, let's just work on the voice today. Okay. So that would be my sort of
amazing
basket of ideas. And, you know, I pick and choose, come up with your own. What's working is what's working, right?
Mm. How is this then going to apply to the vocal coach who, as part of our role, has always been to this point to demonstrate where possible? Is it a case of kind of accepting that we aren't going to be able to demonstrate?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Let me think about that for just one second. well, depending on how you feel about things, one could just mention, I did with my voice studio. I told them what was going on. I had a diagnosis from one of the greatest laryngologists in the country. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that when I would do a pitch, you know, say, let's start here, it would just be a little flat. I couldn't, you know, do high notes like I could before, you know, and I eventually said, I just have to tell them. So I did. I'd explain the situation. It was a teachable moment. I said, so you may have noticed that, you know, these things are happening with my voice. I'm very frustrated with it, but I just want you to know this is why it's happening. Mm. You know, I'm not sick. My voice is not injured, but this seems to be something I'm going through right now. So you could always, you know, say, okay, I used to be able, I'm going to do this down an octave. You know, and I take it down, or just say, I'm not going to do that right now. I think it's okay to just modify what you have to do because your vocal health and comfort is also very, very important as well. But, you know, if you find, I'm not moving as fast as I used to. Well, maybe in your own practice, prioritize patter or, you know, scatting something versus vowelizing something that can help. Anyway, I'm off a little bit on a tangent, but I think if we can just say, okay, here's the thing, this is happening. And this leads me to the huge point that it's very easy to think, menopause voice, it's all down here from now. Not necessarily. In fact, I would say evidence is very good that voice will get better if it's right. in trouble. And we, I have not read this in any other source that I've come across, any like Abit Pal, any of those guys. What happens when chaos levels out post-menopause? And that's what happens. Estrogen, progesterone, much lower, very steady. Mm. What's happening there? Stability. Mm. And we have, in our interviews, we found out pitch problems improve. Stability of voice, this unpredictability levels out. Range sometimes returns, not always, but we have talked to people like, oh, high voice is feeling so much better now. Mm. Agility improves. You know, all these things that were annoying, we've seen a trend toward improvement. Now, the voice may feel different. We may not be able to go back to our old rep, or we may need to change sections, or we may need to change our keys or whatever. But this kind of crazy, you know, merry-go-round crazy stuff stabilizes. Some women find, oh, I got this low voice. I just love it. You know, I torch songs now. I love this. There's very good evidence. And one of the great voice researcher who's actually researching this subject, when asked, she said, yes, one assumption that is going to increase these possibilities that the voice is continuing to be used, mm-hmm. singing, practicing through this transition. Because when you get on the other side, it might be a year or two after, you know, but eventually as the whole system, as the body adapts to being a low estrogen climate, just like mm-hmm. most people don't continue to have hot flushes. They don't continue to have this, that, or the other thing, brain fog, you know, as the body adapts to this new climate. Mm-hmm. Every good reason to think the voice will too, if we make some adaptations as needed. So it's not like the end of the world. I sometimes joke, but I mean it. I would rather be singing now than when I was 49. How old am I? I'm almost 68. Seriously, I'm happier with my voice now than I when I was 49. So I think this is really important to get the word out there, because I'm afraid some people say, oh, it's just going to get worse and worse, I'm quitting now. Not true. Not mm-hmm. true. Continue to go. Plus, the other thing we learned is that sometimes that low estrogen climate we're in, we begin to not care as much about mm-hmm. things. We care less about being perfect. We care less about impressing people. We basically, I have a story to tell. I'm singing my song. You can like it or not, but you know, and I just think it's fabulous. We heard this many times, like, I don't care. This is how I feel. And I don't know if that's like a low estrogen thing or just a life experience, midlife thing. Go for it.
Is there any way for us to prepare for it? Can we do anything other than continue to sing?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm 34, so I've got like, 5 years before I might be teetering into that. And some people might be in that already, like people who experience early perimenopausal symptoms.
Well, I think first of all is just to be aware. I was not aware. That was one of the hardest things, was like, you know, I was very, very surprised. So being aware, just say, okay, this can sometimes happen. There are reasons that it might happen, may happen to me, might not happen to me. So just in case. But again, don't expect vocal ruin. I talked to a woman once who was from Minneapolis. So she had a really good church job in a really fine Episcopal church, you know. And I think she was through her menopause. Yeah, she was like a couple years after her last period. So she was solidly in there, okay? Her voice teacher recommended she talk to me because she was so afraid that her voice was going to fall apart, you know. Her voice teacher, and it was a very fine voice teacher, had told her that when you hit menopause, your voice will dry up and you'll lose your high notes. Now, that was what went into this woman's ear. So that was what she was expecting. Mm. She had not had any trouble. She had a fairly easy perimenopause and her voice was fine. Her choir director was happy with how she was singing. I'm happy with how I'm singing. When is it going to fall apart, you know? Yeah. And after I talked to her, I said, If you were going to have some voice symptoms, you would have had them by now. You would have had them a few years ago, probably, or within a year after your period stopped. That's another time when things could start to shift. And I said, anything? She goes, no, I don't know. I said, well, stop worrying. It's not going to happen to you right now. Okay. So now just take good care of your voice. You know, now you're tripping into your more mature years, but you know, it wasn't going to happen. So, I think just again, I mentioned that evolving, just let your voice be what your voice is. Don't try to fight that. Stay on top of medical issues and voice health issues. We already talked a little bit about voice health. These things can overlap with possible hormonal change. There are some medical things that can happen more frequently in midlife. Thyroid changes, reflux. Reflux is often coming up. We don't quite understand it. Abitbol feels like higher progesterone conditions cause this esophageal sphincter to be a little less effective. Yeah. We don't really know. It could be due to many things, but there is some evidence that reflux happens more often in midlife. So, you know, be aware of those symptoms, how to get them treated, diagnosed. The thyroid thing, thyroid changes are more common in midlife. That's documented. Thyroid changes can cause voice changes, and they can overlap some of these symptoms I was talking about before. So it's important that your doctor keep an eye on your thyroid levels and treat, because they can be reversed. Right. If there's one, Hashimoto syndrome is something that can happen in midlife. That is when it's like super hypothyroid. That can actually really cause the voice to change. But again, and it actually can send you into early menopause. So just having regular doctor visits, go in for your yearly, note changes. I think that's important, because there is that overlap. And then just beware of your vocal health and conditioning. Working with a teacher during this time is, I think, really good. I think if you haven't been studying for whatever reason, I mean, life is super busy and crazy in midlife for females typically anyway. But make that a priority. I think it's so much easier now that we can do online, right? You don't have to take the bus somewhere and whatever. So yeah, working with an informed and sympathetic teacher is really important. Sometimes a singing qualified speech therapist or pathologist can also do this kind of work. I would say for somebody who is a professional, we have all kinds of professionals, but I would say somebody that makes their living singing, you know, pays their rent, everything. That's a particular time to have your team with you. You know, be sure you have your laryngologist, your voice specialist, your gynecologist, your endocrinologist, you know, all these things working together. I think keeping a voice journal is a really good idea, and having it coalesce with your cycles calendar. And what's kind of cool is that there are these really cool apps, if you're comfortable with the apps, because they do collect data. But you don't have to have that. You can make your own little, like, am I having any symptoms? What's going on? How frequently are my periods coming? What is my voice feeling like on this day? Am I noticing any trend for the ceiling of my voice to lower? Or am I getting more low notes? Am I, you know, just doing this? And I think it gives you empowerment to say, oh yeah. The other thing is, change of medication or added medications. That should be in there too, because medications can affect the voice. As we know, blood pressure medications can cause dryness. Just having that as part of your, you know, I don't think you need to journal your voice every single day, but, you know, a couple times a week. I actually still have my little calendars of my cycles, and I flip through them. They're fascinating. I wish I had written more about my voice in there, but every once in a while, I'll have a thing that says crap voice day. Wow, what's going on there? Right. And I think that can be really expanded and make you way more on top, feel less random, you know? It's very, not unlike, you know, keeping your like premenstrual voice syndrome symptoms, being aware of those. So there's that. And then the other thing is, just also, we need to remember that we are not just this thing, right? It's not just our vocal folds. We are musicians. We are performers. We have musical and emotional wisdom. And I don't think that hormones do anything to that. It's just there. We have not become poor musicians or poor communicators, no matter what's going on there, that's not going to leave us, and it's going to serve us well. So I think all those things can, I do believe that they can be helpful. I wish I'd thought about some of those things when I was 42, right? Like when I was coming through all this, the voice experts like Dr. Robert Sadeloff, who you talked about earlier, Dr. Jean-Yves Abitbol, and others, back then, it was sort of like, if you're a singer, you need to get on, you know, if you're low risk and you're a singer, then you need to get on estrogen. That advice is still kind of there, modified somewhat. When I compare editions of these professional voice books, so, and I think this is based on experience, you know, clinical experience. Oh, like so-and-so comes in, she's lost a little off her top, put her on estrogen, top comes back. So it's probably the clinical experience with these caregivers. There is evidence from studies, as I mentioned, that women that are on HRT, the typical voice lowering is moderated somewhat, okay? Another study by my friend Kathy Price, who did a huge PhD study, did show real evidence that the top of the voice was preserved in the women that were on HRT. Type and delivery system were not delineated there, but they just all said HRT. So that showed there. So there is some clinical evidence as well as professional anecdotal evidence that it can be helpful. And we always have to say, this is for low risk women. You know, there's some women that should not take HRT. So that is something that most doctors do not know about. Most doctors do not know about possible voice changes with menopause. So if you are interested in pursuing this, then you probably would have to educate your doctor. A laryngologist would probably know it, but they're not the prescribing person. It's going to be your primary care doctor, general doc, or GYN. It's important to, if you're convinced now, great, you know, but if you're still like, oh, I'm not sure about it, don't you get breast cancer from that, you know, do your homework. There's a lot of really interesting information. If you're, you know, you're assessing risk benefit, very, very important. But when you're doing that research, look at current information. I would say, look at information that's been available for the last 5 years, maybe 5 to 8 years. We are still under the shadow of that WHI study, the World's Women's Health Initiative study, that was canceled very suddenly. All this brouhaha in the press, that has been revisited in so many ways. The women in that part of the study, were the average age was 63, so they were older women that had started hormones later in their life. It's a very different situation from somebody who's 45 or 50. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's all kinds of things that, so that, that study has been re-examined, you know, sifted through. Other studies are out there to balance, counterbalance. So there's some really good websites and books out there that can help you understand, help make your decision with your caregiver. But you probably would have to, if you're saying, yeah, I want to take a pair of my bones, and the hot flushes are gross, but also my voice. I'm a singer, and mm-hmm. this is the other reason I like to approach you with this question. You know, so we're looking through the risk of your own particular health situation, and then going in with, you know, your background information with that talk. Now, I've had to do that with several doctors, but so far everybody's like, oh, I get that, sure, yep. Let's, you know, you're low risk. Let's see how this works. So anyway, there's so much more information than there was earlier. So
yeah,
that's kind of my spiel. I'm not saying it's for everybody. A lot of women just say, no, I just, this is what my body's doing. I just kind of want to go with it, you know, but it's, if you want to know more, good information.
Brilliant. Great. And you have co-authored the book, you've mentioned it, Singing Through Change, Women's Voices in Midlife, Menopause and Beyond. And it goes into loads of detail about this. So what you've mentioned, loads of studies as well. Is there any other resource that you would point us towards to get us into this subject even more?
I think our book is a great place to start. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm trying to sell books, but because it pulls together so much information, you know, a lot of the information that I've already shared with you is in the book, and more. But to me, it's about women. Mm. It's about You can find yourself in the stories in the book. You know, every point we make is undergirded by something that somebody experienced. Mm. And so many, you know, we have elite opera singers, we have jazz singers, we have choral singers, you know, so everybody's in there. And I think that experience of midlife and beyond is so important. I think the oldest woman was 88, the youngest was 38, I think. So we have this long range. So I think as a woman, it's fascinating to just kind of see yourself in those stories. We have voice health information. We have information on reflux, GERD, and LPR. And so we actually covered so much more stuff than we thought we were going to. So mm-hmm. that's why I recommend it. And I think, appreciate it. You know, it is available in the UK. I think
yes.
Amazon.
Where can we, on Amazon, is it?
Amazon. It's also, you can get an audio book and ebook. So there are lots of ways to get it. You can check that out on the Facebook page, which is website, singingthroughchange.com. Is there what's where it is? So yeah. So Kate, I gotta name my buddies, Kate Fraser Neely and Nancy Voss are my co-authors, and we're very close. Yeah. Yeah. Spent a lot of time together writing this book. So other sources, it depends on, like, if you're kind of medically, if you like reading, you know, voice research, Journal of Voice has a number of things, but also, well, actually, we have a huge, huge bibliography in the book. So if you're looking for studies that Philippe Alain is doing, that's, you can find all kinds of good stuff. Speech hearing research, Journal of Singing, there's some stuff in there. So yeah, there, if you want to get into the, go down the rabbit hole, good place to look. I will mention Philippe Alain, who is in Madrid, and she is a voice researcher. She has a large study that is now in its third year now, I think, and it's called Voice at Menopause. And maybe we can put that link there. And they're doing they've done a big survey a couple of years ago. I don't know how many hundreds of women filled out a survey on their voice during this period of time. It's been difficult with COVID to do actual face-to-face stuff, but they're doing, you know, like acoustic exams, laryngeal exams. They've done a couple of literature reviews, yielding some good stuff. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, that website has, some links and a couple of videos. And so she's a wonderful ally. I'm really proud to know her and be at least an onlooker of what's going on there. One of the most wonderful things that has been done are research done in PhD and DMA dissertations, mm-hmm. and some master's theses. Those are out there. Those have been very valuable to us as well. They're not published for the most part, but they're out there, can be found. So that's another really good resource.
Brilliant.
Sorry.
Thank you so much. It's been so insightful to this subject. Where can people find out more about you and follow you as this goes on?
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you, I'm not much on social media. I have my little own Facebook site, but that's a little bit more about family and friends. Though I do, if I'm going to present somewhere, I tend to pop that up there. But we do have a Facebook page, a closed group. We have 2,700 people on there, all genres, all genders, all from all over the world. The site is not super active right now because we stepped back from that. But boy, if you want to get on that thing, there the thread discussions that are still available, you can search. Really, that site went so many places we were not prepared for. Really, really important stuff. So that has a lot of information. So it's Singing Through Change. Just look that up on Facebook, and happy to admit. So there's that. We do have Insta, so it's Singing Through Change, but it's THRUs at Singing Through Change. So there's some activity on Instagram. Other than that, and then our Facebook page, our website, which is singingthroughchange.com. A related group called Celebrate Singing has sometimes, there are some older conferences you can look at. I think you have to do a purchase price or something. There may be upcoming events with Celebrate Singing. So there you would find them. So
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed being with you today.
Oh gosh, Alexa, it's been great. Your prep questions were really got me on my toes. It was very, very helpful to be thinking about these things a little bit ahead of time, and you've been a wonderful interviewer. Thank you.
Looking to expand your vocal knowledge and add to your teacher toolbox? Then you're in the right place. BASTA here to guide you with our membership, a growing virtual library packed with educational videos spanning a whole host of voice teacher topics. It's just £1 for the first 2 weeks and £6 each month after that. Now that's what I call a bargain. To join, just head to our website, www.basttraining.com.